Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. I'm Jamie, here with John. John, I am just in the best mood.
That's good. I'm glad you are.
It's rare, right? Like, I'm usually the grumpy one. Would you agree with that?
I mean, I think...
I won't be insulted.
I think a couple of months ago, you started taking Magic Mind, and I don't think that you're grumpy anymore. You're killing it over on TikTok. Well, I don't think you're always in a bad mood.
Okay, that's good. You should tell my wife that. Before we get into the episode, I just want to give you all an offer again to get a discount on Magic Mind. Magic Mind really drives me every day. I do not miss a single day with my mental performance shot from Magic Mind. The benefits are mind-blowing. I have so much more energy. I have so much more clarity of mind. It doesn't replace my coffee. It doesn't make me jittery, but it gives me the clarity and the energy to get through my day. No more afternoon sleepy time, no more grogginess in the morning to get up. I wake up, I feel great, I take the shot of Magic Mind, and I go throughout the day, and I am a better version of myself when I take it. And this is the last time we're going to be able to offer this big of a discount. This gets you 40% off your subscription, and it's only available for the first 10 orders that are placed. It's at magicmind.com/VIPJandJ40. That's code VIPJandJ40 to get 40% off of a subscription. This product will change your life. No exaggeration. Could not recommend it more. Again, magicmind.com/VIPJandJ40. We have the second part today of the Golden State Killer phenomenal story, one that has resolution, which I know we always talk about justice being served and what leads to that. And this is a fascinating story that I think opens the door for so many cold cases to be solved. So really excited about that. Before we jump into it, though, I have a couple of reviews I would like to read. 5-star reviews over on Apple Podcasts. If you like what we do here, this is the best way to help us. This comes from Becca Leaf. It said, just found your podcast and it's so great. Love you guys. Love you too. And also Millie Boulding says, love you guys. So a lot of love coming in from the Apple Podcast reviews over there. We love you guys too. And we are super thankful that people actually listen to us. And this is a conversation that's been a long time coming.
Well, and again, like, we talk about crime and awful things every single week. So to have some positivity in our lives really goes a long way. So thank you so much, everybody who wrote those. And yeah, we love you too.
Yep, we really appreciate that. And let's just start out, John, I guess, with a summary of last week. We talked about the Golden State Killer is the point of identification that this person has now, but he didn't start out as a killer, did he?
No, he started as what was it? The Vasilla Ransacker.
Yep.
Then he would go on to become known as the East Area Rapist. And then what was the last one?
The Original Night Stalker.
So all three of these names are associated with three different types of crimes that he would commit. So he started as the Ransacker, basically going into people's homes, not really stealing things that were super valuable, but stealing keepsakes and precious, you know, like precious belongings of people that would be irreplaceable. Then he moved on to rape, where he would stalk. He would use some of the original MO, like he would go into their house, make himself at home. But while he was there, he would rape women before ransacking the home and taking things. And then ultimately he would escalate to the final nickname before the Golden State Killer. And that was the Original Night Stalker, which involved all of those things, but then escalated even further to commit murders.
And this is, like I said, this is an escalation. I think if you were to draw a line and say, how do people become killers? This is how it could happen. But he robbed 110 people and raped over 50 people before he started killing. So it was kind of a slow escalation, thankfully, but killed a lot of people nonetheless. In this case, is Cold. As far as we know, he hasn't killed since 1986. And then it wasn't until 2001 that Paul Holes from the Contra Costa County Investigator's Office was able to use DNA to link these crimes together to put them all under the same umbrella. And then we have Michelle McNamara, who is an author, and she started a blog, really got fascinated, passionate about this case, and started writing about it and doing an investigation. And that's where we're going to start today. This starts in 2006. When she started a blog, 2011 is when she started on this case. And that's the first step toward figuring out who this guy is. So, John, get us rolling in Michelle's story.
Yeah, definitely want to start with Michelle. But again, that was an overview. If you missed last week's episode, you really should hit pause now. Go listen to that and then come back. Now, let's talk more about Michelle McNamara. Michelle was a stay-at-home mom and was married to a comedian named Patton Oswalt. Jamie, are you familiar with Patton and any of his work? Like, would anybody know him from anything?
Oh, yeah, I am, and you are too, once you finally see his face. Those are not good images I'm showing you, I don't think. He's in a ton of different TV shows. I think he was on the Drew Carey Show. Probably most, the thing I think about is he had a role in Parks and Recreation where he did like a filibuster about Star Wars. That was a lot of fun. That was one of his more recent ones that I liked.
Dude, he's been on so many things. And I had no idea that that was who Patton was until this case. But she said of this case that she was obsessed and it's not healthy. I mean, it was almost like this was a part of her life. You know, you and I have kids who play sports and we're involved in so many different things. Like, she was obsessed with this case. This was a part of her DNA. It almost appeared to be that way. She studied composite sketches of this guy's face to try to figure out who he was. She knew his shoe size. She knew his blood type. She would spend her evenings after her family went to bed looking online for any new details on cold cases, hoping to find that one clue that might potentially crack the case. And then, like you said, she began writing a book on all of the things that she was learning and had learned about the case. However, tragically, on April 21st, 2016, Michelle died suddenly in her sleep, leaving behind her husband and her young child. At the time of her death, she had 3,500 files related to the Golden State Killer case and 37 boxes of case files from an Orange County prosecutor. This woman had more stuff about this case than probably anybody, any detective, because she accumulated it all.
Leading expert on this topic, for sure.
So this is, I don't know, this is just so sweet. Her husband and her research partners would go on to finish her book and release it after her death, and it was called I'll Be Gone in the Dark. And in the epilogue, she addresses the killer directly by saying, open the door, show us your face, walk into the light.
Yeah, and this is Patton Oswalt finishing this book is how I became aware of this case, because he did kind of a media tour about it. And this was around the time that you and I were starting to get into true crime and thinking about starting the show. So it was certainly of interest to me back then. And that's how it fell into my ears for the first time. On June 15th of 2016, the FBI released more information related to these crimes, some more composite sketches, some more details about the crimes that they had been withholding, and announced a new $50,000 reward leading to the arrest and prosecution of the Golden State Killer. The announcement also included a national database to support investigation of the crime and handle any incoming tips. By the following year, in December of 2017, Paul Holes, who made that first DNA connection back in 2001, uploaded the killer's DNA profile from a Ventura County rape kit to the website GED Match. GED Match is a Florida-based website that pools genetic profiles shared publicly by their owners. The name GED Match, it's actually pronounced GED Match, refers to the file format GEDCOM, which is a file type that was developed by the Mormon Church to share genealogical information, and digital family tree. So it uses genetics to map out who's related to who and your ancestors and that kind of thing. So GEDmatch is a public site for people looking to find missing relatives, or you can go in and fill in family trees if you know how it all fits together. Most of its tools are free, and the platforms run mostly by volunteers. Users just have to register and then upload their raw DNA files exported from a genetic testing service like 23andMe, Ancestry.com. So this is the first time that I know of that we started looking at this familial genetic material as something to link to crimes. John, I know that you've taken part in some of these DNA profiles. How would you feel about uploading your raw DNA file to a public website?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds a little weird when you say it like that. The reason I did the Ancestry.com was to learn more about my family tree, to learn more about my background. So I don't know, you catch me on a weird day, I would probably be like, yeah, I'll upload it because maybe I have some family members who are doing the same and I can 100% accurately decide, okay, this is my great-great-great-great grandfather. Would, you know, so I find it interesting. So probably I would do it. Yeah.
And you know, like we talk about privacy, and it's not like, at least at this point in society, it's not your bank information. It's not like, what are people going to do if they have your DNA? And we're going to find out some things that can be done. But as of right now, people aren't out there misusing DNA that I know of. So I don't know that the risk is there currently. It may eventually be, but that's kind of where we're at.
Well, and you know, I have nothing to hide as far as any past crimes that I've done, so I'm not worried about it. But what's interesting...
Why do you keep winking at me when you say that? Okay, okay, John, okay.
What's interesting about this is they don't even have to have my direct DNA to associate me with a crime, because if I have a cousin or a family member who submits theirs, I'm linked to that, you know?
Also, if you have cousins that have committed crimes or distant relatives... My God. You submit yours, you could get them caught.
See, I have submitted mine, and I honest to God can't believe I haven't got phone calls yet because yeah. I have some wild cousins out there.
John, who's somebody who's 3 degrees removed from you that might stab somebody?
47 people in Georgia would be my response. So you got to be more specific. So 23andMe and Ancestry.com do not just allow law enforcement to come in and access their customer database without a court order, but we can say that neither 23andMe or Ancestry was approached by any investigators in this case, which is kind of mind-blowing, right? Like, I feel like they would have good grounds to get a subpoena or a court order. They should probably have went down that avenue, right?
Well, we're going to get into it, but I think because of GEDmatch being a free service and people voluntarily uploading things there and GEDmatch not having the same type of protocols, that they didn't have to go straight back to the source. They knew, we have this DNA. It was given to 23andMe, but this is how we're going to use it from GEDmatch.
GEDmatch had 650,000 genetically connected profiles, so they were able to just go to that without any kind of warrant. So when they were able to dig around in there, their search found the killer's great-great-great-grandparents dating back to the 1800s and then connecting him to approximately 25 different family trees. So for the next 4 months, there was a team of 5 investigators who worked with a genealogist, her name was Barbara Ray Venter, to create a large family tree. And that tree would include approximately 1,000 people, 1,000 people that investigators had to comb through to find who their right person was. And at the end of this, it led investigators to the doorstep of 72-year-old retired grocery store warehouse worker Joseph James DeAngelo.
Man, I know you wanted to look up your ancestors, and when I think about that, I think of a lineage, the word line of my father, my grandfather, my grandmother, my great-great-grandmother, and so forth all the way up. But the higher up you get, the broader it gets too, and I don't know that, like, do people think about that? Is I'm going to find my 45th. I could find my 45th cousin if I wanted to because of how this tree is built out.
Yeah. When I look at mine, I'm more interested in the line, right? But yes, there are what, like if I open up my Ancestry app, because other members of my family, quote unquote, like have done their family trees. So I am technically associated with like, you know, 40 or 50 family trees, because the further back you go, the wider the net gets, right?
So you could be on a list. You could have been on this list of 1,000 people who could potentially go back 4 generations and be connected to Joseph DeAngelo.
Yeah, I mean, potentially. And dude, wouldn't this be fun almost to work? Because, all right, we found 40 different family trees. There's 1,000 people that we could look at. What criteria do we need to establish in order to rule mass quantities of these people out? So they eventually were able to do that in a way and look into James or Joseph James DeAngelo.
Yeah, it sounds like some kind of puzzle, which I really enjoy. It's kind of what I do in analytics for my job. So you're right. That does sound fun to me to work with that kind of data. But let's talk a little bit more about who this identified potential killer is. Joseph James DeAngelo Jr. was born on November the 8th, 1945 in Bath, New York. Bath, New York, think back to our episode on the Kiff family murders. Took place in that same area. It's where Ryder McKenzie, where her lineage would trace her back to. The parents of Joseph James DeAngelo were Kathleen Louise DeGrote and Joseph James DeAngelo Sr. Joe Sr. was a sergeant in the United States Air Force, and this military lifestyle took the family all over the world. Between 1959 and 1960, DeAngelo attended Mills Junior High School in Rancho Cordova, California, which is where our crime started. In 1961, he attended Folsom High School, where he played on the JV baseball team. He did not graduate from high school, but did get his GED in 1964. Prosecutors would later report that during their high school years, they found out that DeAngelo committed burglaries, mail theft, and he was known to torture and kill animals, which we know is an important piece of the McDonald Triad, which is identified as an indicator of serial killers.
He was born right at the tail end of the World War II, which made him a baby boomer. So if a boomer's ever saying something to you for being a millennial or Gen X or whatever you find yourself as, just gently remind them that your generation included the Golden State Killer, all right? In September of 1964, DeAngelo would go on to join the U.S. Navy himself. He would serve 22 months during the Vietnam War. In August of 1968, DeAngelo went to Sierra College in Rockland, California, where he received an associate degree in police science. Then he went to Sacramento State University in 1971, where he would earn a bachelor's degree in criminal justice. And he later took a postgraduate course and had police training at the College of Sequoia in Visalia, where Claude Snelling taught journalism. Then DeAngelo completed a 32-week police internship at the police department in Roseville. From May 1973 to August 1976, DeAngelo was a burglary unit police officer in Extra California. Now, dude, we haven't even started to talk about all the speculation around this case, but a lot of people thought that he would go on and never be caught because he knew how police worked, because maybe he was a police officer himself.
Right. And a lot of people, there are all kinds of Zodiac stuff coming out now, theories of him being an officer.
So the city that he was working in, Exeter, this is a town right next to Visalia, where the ransacker would eventually strike. From 1976 to 1979, he served in Auburn, California, just 30 miles outside of Sacramento, essentially in the sphere of the East Area Rapist. In July of 1979, DeAngelo was arrested for shoplifting, and it was a hammer that he had stolen and dog repellent. Again, he was a police officer, not a mailman, Also didn't know that there was such a thing as dog repellent.
I'm sorry that my dogs probably make you feel the need for that sometimes.
He was sentenced to 6 months probation and fired from his job in October of that year, again, 1979. During the process of being fired, D'Angelo threatened to kill the police chief and allegedly stalked the chief's house.
With his law career in his rearview mirror, D'Angelo looked to settle down a bit. When we get back, we'll talk about his first big relationship and when he started ransacking Vasilla. In May of 1970, while studying for his associate's degree, D'Angelo became engaged to a nursing student named Bonnie. She ended the relationship in 1971 after D'Angelo reportedly became abusive and manipulative. The final straw of this relationship was when D'Angelo demanded that Bonnie help him cheat on an abnormal psychology test. A serial killer taking abnormal psychology. That's a deep dive I'd like to go into. After they broke up, he tried to force her to marry him by threatening her with a gun. One of the future rape victims claimed that while he was raping her, the assailant that we now know as D'Angelo started crying and said out loud, "I hate you, Bonnie."
Wow. What a crazy thing. In November of 1973, while working in the burglary unit in Exeter, D'Angelo married Sharon Marie Huddle. In 1980, they purchased a house in Citrus Heights, right in the area that the killer would eventually make his hunting ground. Sharon became a divorce attorney in 1982, and the couple had three daughters. Two were born in Sacramento, and one was born in Los Angeles. Sharon and D'Angelo separated one time in 1991. In July of 2018, Sharon officially filed for divorce. D'Angelo's crimes were mostly committed while he was married and had children. Neither his wife nor his children ever suspected him of doing anything so sinister. His oldest daughter wrote a letter saying that he was a perfect father and the best father I could have ever had.
And I think you hear that from a lot of children. You mentioned BTK, and we've talked to one of his daughters quite a bit. She's Carrie Rawson. She's pretty active out on the true crime circuit as an advocate for families. And we've heard her say that too. No suspicion whatsoever. Going back to last week, you recall that the East Area Rapist / original Night Stalker, we now know as the Golden State Killer, took a hiatus from 81 to 86. So this is around the time his wife's finishing school and they're having babies. In April of 2018, authorities who were surveilling D'Angelo, again, they had tracked him down via familial DNA from GEDmatch, and somebody in his family tree had submitted their DNA. They were able to take a swab and swab his car door handle because they knew that it was probably him, but they had to get the DNA to confirm it. Soon after, they collected another sample of DNA from his trash can outside. He had thrown a tissue away, and they were able to get his DNA off of that. Now, John, this is a privacy question too here. If you throw it away, does that mean it's public property that they don't have to have a warrant to go through your trash? I guess so.
Yeah, and I fully believe that. If you put it on the curb, I feel like it's free game. The police can go through it. I can go through it. I mean, yeah, you've thrown it away. It's not yours anymore.
And again, I hope that my DNA doesn't match anybody in my family tree to crimes, because I don't want anybody in my family tree to commit crimes, right?
This is a random story, but it made me think of it. One time early in my marriage, we needed more cash. So I had a friend who owned apartments. And people would just get evicted and they would leave literally everything behind, right? So I would help this guy. He would give me like a few hundred bucks to go in and take everything out of the apartment, paint it, get it ready for leasing again.
Right.
The rule was, or actually he made it sound like it was a law. I didn't research it, but he's like, they've left all this stuff. You can't just take it out of the apartment and put it in your car. Like, because there was one time there was a PlayStation left and I wanted the PlayStation, right?
Of course.
But he's like, so you have to throw it away. And I was like, okay, I'll throw it away. So I took the PlayStation to the dumpster and I put it in the dumpster and I stood there for a minute. And then I reached in the dumpster and I got it out and I took it to my car.
Yeah.
I followed the law. So I was just thinking, like, if there was a legal loophole, they could just let the trash man pick it up and say, hey guys, I need that bag of trash.
Yeah.
And then there's a way to do it.
Did he instruct you to do that, or was that just your creativity?
No. He told me to throw everything away. You cannot have anything out of this apartment. So I threw it away, but then I dumpster dove, which I don't know if that's illegal where I live or not. But
I think it depends on the dumpster, to be honest. I'm not really sure.
I followed my employer's rules, and I felt like I found a loophole.
Well, they got this DNA from his trash can and from his car door handle. Again, not sure how, which they may have had a warrant. I'm not really sure about that. Both of these samples came back, and as much as you can match DNA, which is pretty tight, right? It was a match to the Golden State Killer and like everything they had.
99.999.
After he was arrested, he was brought to the station, and according to the Sacramento County prosecutor, D'Angelo was trying to create a story of multiple personalities to say that may be my DNA, but it wasn't me. I didn't do that. He said, I didn't have the strength to push him out. He made me. He went with me. It was like in my head. I mean, he's part of me. I didn't want to do those things. I pushed Jerry out and had a happy life. I did all those things. I destroyed all their lives. So now I've got to pay the price. So acting as if this was an alter ego committing these crimes, and he was able to eventually shed him and move on to have a violent, free life. Now, the statute of limitations on the burglaries in Vasillo had expired, but on April 13th, 2018, D'Angelo was formally charged with first-degree murder, specifically of Claude Snelling, again, that taught at the same small college that D'Angelo went to, and he was the one who caught D'Angelo trying to break into the window in 1975 to kidnap his daughter, and D'Angelo shot him dead before fleeing the scene. He was also charged with 13 counts of first-degree murder with special circumstances, including a murder being committed during burglaries and rapes, and 13 additional counts of kidnapping.
On March the 4th, 2020, while the rest of the world was in COVID protocol.
Actually, that was about a week before it started. So this was the very end of life as we knew it.
You're right. Well, on March 4th, he offered to plead guilty if the death penalty was taken off the table, which was accepted as part of the plea deal on June 29th of 2020. On August 21st, the same year, D'Angelo received multiple consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. In November 2020, he was transferred to the North Kern State Prison. As of February 2021, D'Angelo was put in protective custody at the California State Prison. After days of pre-sentencing victim impact statements, D'Angelo offered a brief apology saying, I've listened to all your statements, each one of them. I'm truly sorry to everyone I've hurt. And like I tell my children, sometimes when they apologize, I would reply, you're sorry because you got caught.
Yep. Yeah. And he went on to, as far as we know, his last kill was 1986. He went on to call people for 15 more years to psychologically torture his former victims that he had robbed and raped. So to say that he always had some kind of remorse, I do not believe in any way. But, John, what does this say about other cold cases? Now, I don't know that we have DNA in all cold cases, and I know there are complications with, we only have a little bit of DNA. Do we test it now? But does this open the door for us to find out who the Zodiac Killer was, to figure out who Jack the Ripper was? Like, these older very high profile cases that don't seem like they're going to be solved using conventional means.
Yeah, dude, I'm really excited. I feel like we are living in just excellent times in regards to the amount of cold cases that can potentially be solved. And it really goes back to, did police do their due diligence in collecting evidence at the scene that can now be used as with potential matches in these ancestry websites? There are cases in this county that are solved today, and people are awaiting arrest that don't even know that their time is being called.
Right.
And it's amazing. And so many families are going to get justice. So many crimes are going to be solved. And most importantly, criminals are going to be off the streets because these are going to be solved. So yeah, I do think it's possible, and I'm super excited about it.
Well, I mean, we were pretty big advocates of getting the Rachel Marin case out there and in the media, and familial DNA led to them finding Victor Martinez Hernandez, who was Rachel Marin's killer. He's still awaiting trial, but that's another, a very recent one that was solved in this way. And it was solved within a year in part because they did have DNA from that crime and another crime, but because he had a relative who had submitted this, I think the conversations moving forward are more about where are we allowed to take this DNA from legally without a warrant. I don't know that I have a good answer for that.
Yeah, man. I don't know, dude. It's awesome times that we're living in, and I can't wait to come on here and talk about more crimes that have been solved because of this kind of technology existing.
So does this mean that everybody should go out there and submit their DNA to support this effort, or does the government have the right to our DNA to solve these crimes?
Look, if I'm suspected of a crime, murder or whatever, and the police have the right to issue a warrant and come into my house, that means they have to present enough evidence to a judge that the judge would warrant this kind of
search. I'm not talking about your DNA. I'm talking about the DNA of the rest of us to try to later potentially use that for our relatives.
So you're asking, do police have the right to make us do that? Is that what you're asking?
The government, not just the police, but is it going in a way of, we can use this to solve so many crimes, but we have a limited supply of DNA, so we're going to start asking people to record their DNA so that we can match it?
I'm fine with that. I don't think the government has the right to say, hey, you have to do this. We're mailing you this DNA tester or whatever. But if the government were to say, hey, we're going to spend, we're going to budget $10 million and we're going to send out every home in America one of these kits for this purpose. If you are so inclined, please send it back with your DNA. Thank you very much. I'm cool with that.
Okay. Yeah. If it's optional, I mean, it's already optional, right? I don't know how 23andMe and Ancestry are changing their policies to match up with this, but
what if the fine print on any COVID test was, we're going to stick this up your nose, we're going to tell you if you have COVID or not, and we're going to send your DNA to the government?
Man, that's golly, that would fall into so many people's conspiracy theory bingo card, and it would just
tip the scales. Did I just invent a new conspiracy theory?
I think you did. I'm going to leave it in though. So if that's the case, then we said it first right here.
Yep.
Guys, we appreciate you. This is, again, a very cold case solved by very fresh technology that we're still kind of on the outskirts of figuring out the best ways to use it. So a huge development in the world of true crime and the world of justice, and it'll be interesting to see how different countries and the future plays out using it.
This has been an awesome case, Jamie. Thank you for suggesting this one. Look, it's the middle of November. If you need more true crime, don't forget that if you have binged everything we have and need more crime, we have over 8 years worth of content available right now on patreon.com, www.patreon.com. While you're there, you can look for your boys, True Crime Cast. For as little as $3 a month, you get one bonus episode every month. And you can listen to all the ones from the last 8 years over there as well. Go check it out.
Absolutely. We thank you guys so much, and we appreciate you checking in. We'll be back with another case next time.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.